Esmeralda handed the basket to Joaquin Messner, but she did not step away. Instead, she lifted the lid, which was lined in a padded rose-covered print, took a needle from the tomato-shaped cushion and a spool of black thread, and threaded the needle. She bit off the thread with a delicate snap and made a neat little knot at the end. All of the men, even the generals, watched her as if she was doing something quite miraculous, something far beyond needles and thread that they could never have managed themselves. Then she reached into her skirt pocket and took out a bottle of rubbing alcohol, into which she lowered the needle and bounced it up and down several times. Sterilization. And here she was, a simple country girl. Nothing could have been as thoughtful. She pulled the needle up, holding only the knot on the thread, and extended it to Joaquin Messner. "Ah," he said, taking the knot between his forefinger and thumb. There was some discussion. First it was thought that they could both stand, and then it seemed better for the vice president to sit down, and then best of all for him to lie down, near a table lamp where the light was best. The two men were stalling, each dreading it more than the other. Messner rubbed his hands in alcohol three times. Iglesias was thinking he would rather be hit by the gun again. He lay down on the carpet away from his wife and children, and Messner bent over him, leaning in and then blocking his own light, leaning back and turning the vice president's head one way and then the other. The vice president tried to make himself think of something pleasant, and so he thought of Esmeralda. It was really quite remarkable how she managed things. Perhaps his wife had taught her that. The concept of bacteria, the need to keep things clean. How lucky he was to have such a girl looking after his children. The blood no longer pulsed, but it continued to seep, and Messner stopped to blot it away with a napkin. Considering the circumstances, the blaring messages pouring in through the windows, the constant on and off of sirens, the hostages stretched across the floor, the terrorists sleepy with their guns and knives, you would have thought that no one would care what became of Rubén Iglesias' cheek. And yet the people craned their necks up like turtles to see what would happen next, to see the needle go down for that first stick.
5 minutes is what you have left,
General Alfredo said. Joaquin Messner pinched the skin closed with his left hand and with his right put the needle in. Thinking that a quick movement would be kinder, he misjudged the thickness of the material at hand and drove the needle hard into the bone. Both men made a noise that was less than a scream, sharp but small, and Messner jerked the needle out again with some effort, leaving them exactly where they had started, except that now the little hole was working up a drop of blood itself. No one had asked for her, but there was Esmeralda cleaning her hands. She had a look on her face the vice president had seen her use with his children. They had tried at something and failed, and she had let things go far enough. She took the needle and thread from Joaquin Messner and bobbed it again in the alcohol. It was with great relief that he moved aside. He did not care about her intentions or qualifications. He only watched her as she bent beside the light. Rubén Iglesias thought her face was kind in the beatific manner of saints, even though she was not exactly smiling. He was grateful for her serious brown eyes, which were now just inches from his own. He would not close his eyes, no matter how great the temptation. He knew that he would never again see such concentration and compassion focused on his face, even if he were to survive this ordeal and live to be 100. When the needle came towards him, he held still and breathed in the grassy smell of her hair. He did feel like a button that had come undone. A pair of child's trousers spread across her warm lap that she sewed in the evening. It was not so bad. He was simply one more thing for Esmeralda to put together again, something else in need of repair. It hurt, the little needle. He did not like to see it pass before his eye. He did not like the small tug at the end of every stitch that made him feel like a trout caught. But he was grateful to be so close to this girl he saw every day. There she was on the lawn with his children sitting on a sheet beneath a tree, pouring them tea in chipped cups, Marco on her lap, his daughters Rosa and Imelda holding dolls. There she was backing into the hallway. Good night, she says. No more water, go to sleep, close your eyes, good night. She was silent in her concentration, and still the very thought of her voice made him relax, and though it hurt, He knew he would be sorry when it was over, when her hip was no longer pressed against his waist. Then she was finished and she made another knot. Like a kiss, she leaned down to him and bit the thread, her lips having no choice but to brush the seam her hands had made. He could hear the quick cutting of her teeth, the disconnection of what bound them, and then she sat up again. She ran her hand across the top of his head, a gift for what he had suffered. "Pretty Esmeralda."
"Very brave," she said.
Anyone who was close enough to see them smiled and sighed. She had done such nice work, laid down a neat train track of even black stitches along the side of his head. It was what one would expect from a girl who had been raised to sew. Marco shinnied back into Esmeralda's arms when she went to rejoin them. He pressed his head against her breasts and breathed her in. The vice president himself did not move. The pain and the pleasure of it were all colliding, and he released himself into the moment. He closed his eyes as if he had been given a proper anesthetic.
"Both of you," the general said to Messner and Genn. "Go lie down. We'll discuss this."
He used his gun to point to the floor, someplace not too close by. Messner did not try to resume negotiations.
"I don't lie down," he said, but his voice was tired enough that one might have thought he would have liked to. "I wait outside. I'll come back again in 1 hour."
With that, he gave a courteous nod to Genn and simply opened the door and let himself out. Genn wondered if he might do the same, explain that he would be waiting outside. But Genn knew he was not Messner. There was no putting one's finger on it exactly, but it was as if there would be no point in shooting Messner. He seemed like someone who had been shot every day of his life and had simply had enough of it. Genn, on the other hand, his mind still full of stitches, was feeling decidedly mortal. Mortal and loyal, and he went to take his place beside Mr. Hosokawa.
"What did they say?" Mr. Hosokawa whispered.
"I think they'll let the women go. It isn't decided yet, but they seem to want to. They say there are too many of us."
On every side of him was a person, some not 6 centimeters away. He felt like he was taking the Yamanote line into the Tokyo station at 8 in the morning. He reached up and loosened his tie. Mr. Hosokawa closed his eyes and felt a calmness spread over him like a soft blanket.
"Good,"
he said. Roxanne Koss would be released, safely off in time to sing in Argentina. Within a few days, the scare of this event would leave her. She would follow their fate through the safety of the newspaper. She would tell the story at cocktail parties, and people would be amazed. But people were always amazed. In Buenos Aires, she would be singing Gilda the first week. It seemed to him the perfect coincidence. She is singing Gilda, and he is still a boy with his father in Tokyo. He watches her from the high seats. From so far away, and yet still her voice is as clear and delicate as it had been when he was standing close enough to touch her. Her bold gestures, her stage makeup are perfect from a distance. She sings with her father, Rigoletto. She tells her father she loves him while in the high stands the boy Katsumi Hosokawa takes his father's hand. The opera pulls up from the tapestry rugs and the half-empty glasses of pisco sours in the living room. It moves away from specific birthdays and factory plans. It rises and turns above the host country until gently it lands on the stage where it becomes its whole self, something distant and beautiful. All of the orchestra supports her now. It reaches with the voices, lifts the voices up. The beautiful voice of Roxanne Koss is singing her Gilda to the young Katsumi Hosokawa, her voice vibrating the tiny bones deep inside his ear. Her voice stays inside him, becomes him. She is singing her part to him and to 1,000 other people. He is anonymous, equal, loved. Lying on the floor at opposite ends of the room were 2 priests of the Holy Roman Catholic Church. Monsignor Roland was behind the sofa the Thibauts were in front of, having thought it would be better to stay away from the windows in case a shooting were to occur. As a leader of his people, he had a responsibility to protect himself. Catholic priests had often been targets in political uprisings. You only needed to look at the papers. His vestments were damp with sweat. Death was a holy mystery.
Its timing was for God alone to decide, but there were vital reasons for him to live. It was thought that the Monsignor was virtually guaranteed the spot of bishop, if and when the present ancient Bishop Romero completed his tenure through death. It was Monsignor Roland, after all, who attended the functions and brokered the deals that made a wider path for the church. Nothing in the world was absolutely certain, not even Catholicism in these poverty-stricken jungles. Just look at the encroaching tide of Mormons with their money and their missionaries. The gall of sending missionaries into a Catholic country, as if they were savages ready for conversion. Lying with his head on a small sofa pillow that he had managed to discreetly pilfer on his way to the floor, his hips still gave him pain, and he thought of how when this was over there would be a long, hot bath, and then he would take at the very least 3 days in his own soft bed. Of course there was a positive way of looking at things, assuming there was no overt madness and he was released in the first wave of hostages. The kidnapping could be just the thing to seal the Monsignor's fate. The publicity of being kidnapped could make a holy martyr even of a man who had escaped unhurt. And this would have been exactly the case, were it not for a young priest who was lying on the cold marble floor in the front hallway. Monsignor Roland had met Father Arguedas, had been present when he received holy orders 2 years ago, but of this he had no memory. This country did not suffer from a lack of young men wanting to sign up for the priesthood. With their short dark hair and stiff black shirts, these priests were as indistinguishable from one another as the children in their first communion whites. The Monsignor had no idea that Father Arguedas was even in the room, never once having set eyes on him during the course of the evening. So how did a young priest come to be invited to a party at the home of the vice president? Father Arguedas was 26 years old and worked as a third-tier parish priest on the other side of the capital city, lighting candles, serving communion, and maintaining duties no higher than those of a well-established altar boy. In the few moments of his day that were not consumed by loving God through prayer and serving the flock through deeds, he went to the library at the university and listened to opera. He sat in the basement, protected by the wings of an old wooden carrel, and listened to recordings through a set of giant black headphones that were too tight and made his head ache. The university was hardly wealthy, and opera was not a priority for spending, so the collection was still on heavy records instead of compact discs. Although there were some pieces he liked better than others, Father Arguedas listened without discrimination. Everything from Die Zauberflöte to Trouble in Tahiti. He closed his eyes and silently mouthed along the words he did not understand. At first he cursed the ones before him, the ones who left their fingerprints on the records or scratched them, or worse, simply took one record away so that there was no third act for Lulu. Then he remembered himself as a priest and went to his knees on the cement floor of the library basement. Too often in these moments of listening, he had felt his soul fill with a kind of rapture, a feeling he could not name but was disquieted by. Longing? Love. Early in his seminary training, he had set his mind to giving up opera, as other young men had set their minds to giving up women. He thought there must be a darkness in such passion, especially for a priest. Lacking any real or interesting sins to confess, he offered up the imagined sin of opera one Wednesday afternoon as his greatest sacrifice to Christ. Verdi or Wagner? Said the voice from the other side of the screen.
Both,
Father Arguedas said, but when he recovered himself from the surprise of the question, he changed his answer.
Verdi.
You are young, the voice replied. Come back and tell me again in 20 years, if God allows that I am here.
The young priest strained to recognize the voice. Certainly he knew all the priests at the San Pedro Church.
Is it not a sin?
Art is not sin. It's not always good, but it is not a sin.
The voice paused for a minute, and Father Arguedas slipped a finger into the black band of his collar, trying to move some of the thick, warm air into his shirt.
Then again, some of the libretti. Well, try to concentrate on the music. The music is the truth of opera.
Father Arguedas took his small, perfunctory penance and said each prayer 3 times as an offering of joy. He did not have to give up his love. In fact, after that he changed his mind completely and decided that such beauty would have to be one with God. The music gave praise, he was sure of that, and if the words too often focused on the sins of man, well, did Jesus himself not explore this subject exactly? When he suffered from any feelings of questionable discomfort, he simply rectified the situation by not reading the libretti. He had studied Latin in seminary, but he refused to make the connection to Italian. Tchaikovsky was especially good in these cases, as Russian escaped him completely. Sadly, there were times when the lust came through the music, rather than the words. Having no understanding of French did not keep a priest safe from Carmen. Carmen gave him dreams. In most instances, though, he was able to pretend that every man and woman in every opera sang with so much grace and splendor because they sang about the love for God in their hearts. Once freed by his confessor, Father Arguedas did not try to hide his love for music. No one seemed to care about his interests one way or the other, so long as it did not take away from the duties of his life. Perhaps it was not a particularly modern country, or a modern religion, but it was a modern age. People in the parish had a fondness for this young priest. The tireless vigor with which he polished the pews, the way he knelt in front of the candles for an hour every morning before First Mass began. Among the people who noticed his good works was a woman named Anna Loya, the favorite cousin of the wife of the vice president. She too had an interest in music and was generous in loaning Father Arguedas recordings. When she heard a rumor that Roxanne Koss was coming to sing at a party, Anna telephoned her cousin to ask if a certain young priest could attend. He wouldn't have to be invited to dinner, of course. He could wait in the kitchen during the dinner. He could wait in the kitchen while Roxanne Koss sang, for all it mattered, but if he could be in the house, even in the garden, she would be very grateful. Father Arguedas had once confided in Anna after a particularly mediocre rehearsal of the church choir that he had never heard opera sung live. The great love of his life, after God, lived only in dark vinyl. Anna had once lost a son more than 20 years before. The boy was 3 when he drowned in an irrigation ditch. There were many other children, and she loved them well and did not speak of the one who was lost. In fact, the only time she ever thought of that child now was when she saw Father Arguedas. She repeated her question to her cousin by telephone. Could Father Arguedas come to hear the soprano? It was different in ways he never could have imagined, as if the voice were something that could be seen. Certainly it could be felt. Even where he stood in the very back of the room, it trembled inside the folds of his cassock, brushed against the skin of his cheeks. Never had he thought, never once, that such a woman existed, one who stood so close to God that God's own voice poured from her. How far she must have gone inside herself to call up that voice. It was as if the voice came from the center part of the earth, and by the sheer effort and diligence of her will, she had pulled it up through the dirt and rock and through the floorboards of the house, up into her feet where it pulled through her, reaching, lifting, warmed by her, and then out of the white lily of her throat and straight to God in heaven. It was a miracle. And he wept for the gift of bearing witness. Even now, after more than 12 hours spent on the floor of the marble entryway, the cold having permeated into his bone marrow, the voice of Roxanne Koss was making large swooping circles through his head. If he had not been told to lie down, he might have been forced to ask if he might be allowed to. He needed all this time to rest, and better that it was on a marble floor. The floor kept him mindful of God. Had he been stretched out on a soft rug, he might have forgotten himself altogether. He was glad to have spent the night in the sea of bullhorns and sirens because it kept him awake and thinking. Glad, and for this he asked forgiveness, to have missed the morning's Mass and Communion because then he could stay there longer. The longer he stayed where he was, the longer the moment continued, as if her voice were still echoing against these papered walls. She was still there, after all, lying someplace where he could not see her, but not so terribly far away. He said a prayer that she had had a comfortable night, that someone would have thought to offer her one of the couches. In addition to his concern for Roxanne Koss, Father Aguedas was worried about the young bandits. Many of them were propped upright against the walls, their feet apart, leaning on their rifles like walking sticks. Then their heads would drop back and they would fall asleep for 10 seconds before their knees buckled and they slumped into their guns. Father Arguedas had often gone with the police to collect the bodies of suicides, and often they looked like they must have begun in exactly such a position, their toes pressed down on the trigger.
"Son,"
he whispered to one of the boys who was guarding the people in the entry hall, mostly waiters and cooks laid on the hard floor, people of the lowest ranking. Being young himself, he often felt uncomfortable calling a parishioner son, but this child, he felt, was his own. He looked like his cousins. He looked like every boy who ran from the church as soon as they had taken communion, the host still white and round on their tongues.
"Come here."
The boy squinted towards the ceiling as if he was hearing the voice in his sleep. He pretended not to notice the priest.
"Son,"
Father Arguedas said again.
"Come here."
Now the boy looked down, and a puzzlement crossed his face. How did one not answer a priest? How was it possible not to go if called?
"Father," he whispered. "Come here,"
the priest mouthed and patted his hand on the floor, nothing more than a little fluttering movement of his fingers beside him. It was not crowded on the marble floor. Unlike the carpeted living room, there was plenty of space to stretch here, and when one had been leaning against a rifle all night, an open expanse of marble floor would seem as inviting as a feather bed. The boy looked nervously around the corner to the place where the generals were in conference.
"I'm not allowed,"
he mouthed. He was an Indian, this boy. He spoke the language from the north that Father Aguedas's grandmother spoke to his mother and aunts.
"I say you are allowed,"
he said, not with authority, but with compassion. The boy considered this for a moment and then turned his head up, as if he was studying the intricate crown molding that ringed the ceiling. His eyes filled up with tears, and he had to blink madly to hold them back. He had been awake for such a long time, and his fingertips trembled around the cool barrel of his gun. He could no longer exactly tell where his fingers stopped and the green-blue metal began. Father Arguedas sighed and let it go for now. He would ask the boy again later, just to let him know there was a place to rest and forgiveness for any sin. The crowd on the floor pulsed with needs. Some had to go to the bathroom again. There were murmurings about medications. People wanted to stand up, to be fed, to have a drink of water to wash the taste from their mouths. Their restlessness emboldened them, but there was this as well. Nearly 18 hours had passed and still no one was dead. The hostages had begun to believe that they might not be killed. If what a person wants is his life, he tends to be quiet about wanting anything else. Once the life begins to seem secure, one feels the freedom to complain. Viktor Fyodorov, a Muscovite, finally gave in to himself and lit up a cigarette, even though all lighters and matches were to have been surrendered. He blew his smoke straight up to the ceiling. He was 47 years old and had been smoking regularly since he was 12, even in hard times, even when decisions had to be made between cigarettes and food. The General Benjamin snapped his fingers and one of the minions rushed forward to take Fyodorov's cigarette away, but Fyodorov only inhaled. He was a big man, even lying down, even with no weapon save the cigarette itself. He looked like the one who would win the fight.
"Just try," he said to the soldier in Russian.
The boy, having no idea what had been said, was unsure of how to proceed. He tried to steady his hand when he withdrew his gun and pointed it at Fyodorov's middle in a half-hearted way.
"This is it,"
Yegor Ledbed, another Russian and a friend of Fyodorov, said.
"You will shoot us for smoking."
What a dream it was, that cigarette. How much more delightful it was to smoke when one had not smoked in a day. Then one could notice the flavor, the blue tint of the smoke. One could relax into the pleasant lightheadedness one remembered from boyhood. It was almost enough to make a man quit so that he could know the pleasure of starting again. Fyodorov was almost down to the point of burning his fingers. What a pity. He sat up, startling the gunman with his girth, and crushed the cigarette against the sole of his shoe. To the great pleasure of the vice president, Fyodorov put the butt in the pocket of his tuxedo, and the boy stuffed the gun awkwardly back into the waistband of his pants and slunk away. "I will not take this another minute," a woman shouted, but when they looked around, no one could be sure who had spoken. 2 hours after Joachim Messner had left, General Benjamin summoned the vice president up from the floor and had him open the door and wave Messner back in. Was it possible that Messner had spent all this time waiting just outside the door? His delicate cheeks looked even more scorched than before.
"Everything all right?"
Messner said to the vice president in Spanish, as if he had spent the last 2 hours standing in the sun working on his language skills. "Very little changes," the vice president said in English in an attempt to be thoughtful. He still had some vestiges of feeling like the host.
"Your face, it isn't bad. She did a very good job with the..."
He struggled for the word.
"So,"
he said finally. The vice president lifted his fingers to his cheek, but Messner held his hand down.
"Don't touch it."
He looked around the room.
"The Japanese man, is he still here?"
"Where would he go?" Ruben asked. Messner glanced around at the bodies at his feet, all of them warm and taking even breaths. Really, he had seen worse.
"I'm going to call for the translator,"
the vice president told the generals, who looked away from them, as if they had not noticed that Messner had arrived. Then finally, one of them glanced up and gave some sort of brief sideways gesture with his eyebrows that Ruben Iglesias took to mean, "Fine, go ahead." He did not call for Gen, but walked the long way around the room to get to him. It was both an opportunity to stretch his legs and to take inventory of his guests. Most people gave something between a wince and a smile upon seeing him. The side of his face really was swelling horribly without ice, the stitches already strained against the burden of keeping his face together. Ice. It wasn't like he was looking for penicillin. There was plenty of ice in the house. There were two freezers, one side by side with the refrigerator in the kitchen and one in the basement just for storage. There was also a machine in the kitchen that stood separately and did nothing but pour forth ice all day into a plastic cabinet. And yet he knew he was not a favorite with these generals, and to request so much as a cube might mean the closing of his other eye. How lovely it would be just to stand with his cheek resting lightly against the cool white metal of the freezer door. He didn't even need the ice, that would be enough.
"Monsignor," he said, stepping around Monsignor Roland on the floor. "I'm so sorry. Are you comfortable?" "Yes, good, good."
It was a beautiful house, a beautiful rug on which his guests crowded together. Who would have thought that he would one day live in such a house with two freezers and a machine that made only ice? It had been a spectacular piece of luck. His father lifted baggage onto flatbed carts, first for the trains and then for the airlines. His mother raised 8 children, sold vegetables, took in needlework. How many times had that story been told? Ruben Iglesias, working his way up, the first in his family to finish high school. Worked as a janitor to put himself through college. Worked as a janitor and a judge's clerk to put himself through law school. After that, there was a successful career in the law, the correct steps on the unstable ladder of politics. It made him as attractive a running mate as his height. Never in the story did they mention how he had married well. The daughter of a senior partner he had made pregnant during a festive Christmas party. How the ambitions of his wife and her parents pushed him forward, that was a decidedly less interesting story. A man on the floor near the tapestry wing-backed chair asked him a question in a language Ruben believed was German. The vice president told him he did not know. Gen, the translator, was lying very close to Mr. Hosokawa. He whispered something in Mr. Hosokawa's ear, and the old man closed his eyes and nodded his head almost imperceptibly. Ruben had forgotten all about Mr. Hosokawa. "Happy birthday, sir," he thought to himself. I don't suppose there will be any factories built this year. Not too far from them was Roxanne Koss and her accompanist. She looked, if this was possible, even better than she had the night before. Her hair was loose and her skin glowed as if she had been waiting for this opportunity to rest.
How are you?
She mouthed in English and touched her hand to her own cheek to indicate her concern for his injury. Perhaps it was the fact that he had had nothing to eat. Maybe it was exhaustion or blood loss or the onset of an infection, but at that moment, he was quite sure he would faint. The way she touched her face did it because she could not stand and put her hand to his own cheek. The image of her standing and touching his cheek. He sank down to the floor, balancing on his toes, putting his hands down in front of him, and dropped his head forward until the feeling passed. Slowly he raised his eyes to hers, which now looked panicked.
"I'm well," he whispered.
At that moment he noticed her accompanist, who frankly did not look well at all. It seemed that if Roxanne Koss was able to extend such compassion to him, she should take a look at the man lying next to her. His paleness had a decidedly gray cast, and while his eyes were open and his chest moved in a shallow way, there was a stillness about him that the vice president thought was not good at all.
"Him?"
he said softly and pointed. She looked at the body beside her as if she was noticing it for the first time.
"He says he has the flu. I think he's very nervous."
Speaking in the very smallest of whispers, the sound of her voice was thrilling, even if he wasn't exactly sure what she was saying.
"Translator!" General Alfredo called out.
Ruben had meant to stand and extend his hand to Gen, but Gen, younger, made it to his feet more quickly and reached down to help the vice president. He took Ruben's arm, as if the vice president had been struck suddenly blind, and led him forward through the room. How quickly one could form attachments under circumstances like these. What bold conclusions a man could come to. Roxanne Koss was the woman he had always loved. Gen Watanabe was his son. His house was no longer his own. His life as he knew it, his political life, was dead. Ruben Iglesias wondered if all hostages all over the world felt more or less the same way.
"Gen,"
Messner said, and shook his hand somberly as if offering condolences.
"The vice president should have medicine."
He said this in French for Gen to translate.
"Too much time is spent discussing the needs of a foolish man,"
General Benjamin said.
"Ice?"
Ruben offered himself, as suddenly his mind was filled with the pleasures of ice, of the snow on the tops of the Andes, of those sweet Olympic skaters on television, young girls wearing handkerchiefs of diaphanous gauze around their doll-like waists. He was burning alive now, and the silver blades of their skates shot up arches of blue-white chips. He wanted to be buried in ice.
"Ishmael,"
the general said impatiently to one of the boys.
"Into the kitchen. Get him a towel and ice."
Ishmael, one of the young boys holding up the wall, a small one with the worst shoes of all, looked pleased. Maybe he was proud of having been chosen for the task. Maybe he wanted to help the vice president. Maybe he wanted a shot at the kitchen, where surely trays of leftover crackers and melted canapes were waiting.
"No one gives my people ice when they need ice," General Alfredo said bitterly.
"Certainly,"
Messner said, half listening to Gen's translation.
"Have you reached some kind of compromise here?" "We let you have the women,"
General Alfredo said.
"We have no interest in harming women. The workers can go, the priests, anyone who is sick. After that, we'll review the list of who we have. There may be a few more to go after that. In return, we'll want supplies."
He produced a piece of paper, neatly folded, from his front pocket, and clamped it between the three remaining fingers of his left hand.
"These are the things we'll need. The second page is to be read to the press, our demands."
Alfredo had been so certain their plan would turn out better than this. It had been his cousin, after all, who had once worked on the air conditioning system of this house, and had managed to steal a copy of the blueprints. Messner took the papers and scanned them for a minute, and then asked Gen to read them. Gen was surprised to find his hands trembling. He could never remember an instant when what he was translating had actually affected him. On behalf of the people, La Familia de Martin Suarez has taken hostage. Messner raised his hand for Gen to stop.
La Familia de Martin Suarez?
The general nodded.
Not La Dirección Auténtica?
Messner kept his voice down.
You said we were reasonable men,
General Alfredo said, his voice swelling with the insult.
What do you think? Do you think La Dirección Auténtica would be talking to you? Do you think we would be letting the women go? I know LDA. In LDA, the ones who are not useful are shot. Who have we shot? We are trying to do something for the people. Can you understand that?
He took a step towards Messner, who knew how it was intended, but Gen moved quietly between them.
We are trying to do something for the people,
Gen said, keeping his tone deliberate and slow. The second part of the sentence, can you understand that, was irrelevant, and so he left it off. Messner apologized for his mistake, an honest mistake. They were not LDA. He had to concentrate to keep the corners of his mouth from bending up.
How long before the first group can be released?
General Alfredo could not speak to him. He ground down on his teeth. Even General Hector, who had the least to say, spat on the Savonnier carpet. Ishmael returned with two dish towels full of ice cubes, a sign of the great abundance the kitchen held. General Benjamin batted one of the sacks from his hand, sending the clear diamond ice tripping and bouncing across the carpet. Anyone close enough scooped up the extra cubes and slipped them into their mouths. Ishmael, frightened now, quickly gave the remaining bag to the vice president with a slight bow of the head. Rubain returned the nod, thinking it best not to draw any more attention to himself than was absolutely necessary, as clearly it would take little to provoke another gun butt to the side of the head. He touched the ice to his face and winced with the pain and the deep, deep pleasure of the cold. General Benjamin cleared his throat and pulled himself together.
We'll divide them up now, he said.
First he spoke to his troops.
Look alert, on your guard.
The boys against the wall straightened out their legs and lifted their guns to their chests.
Everyone on your feet, he said.
I beg for your attention, Gen said in Japanese. It is now time to stand.
If the terrorists minded speaking, they made an exception for Gen. He repeated the sentence again in as many languages as he could think of. He said it in languages he knew he need not include, Serbo-Croatian and Cantonese, just because there was comfort in speaking and no one tried to stop him. Stand up is not a message that needed translation in the first place. People are sheep about certain things. When some begin to stand, the rest will follow. They were stiff and awkward. Some people tried to work their way back into their shoes, and others just forgot them. Some people stomped lightly on one foot, trying to wrestle it from sleep. They were nervous. As much as they had been thinking that all they wanted was to stand, now that they were on their feet, they felt insecure. It seemed so much more likely that transitions would be bad rather than good, that standing increased the likelihood of being shot.
The women will stand to the far right of the room, and the men to the far left.
Gen churned the sentence through the different languages with no clear idea of which countries were represented or who was in need of a translator. His voice was full of the soothing monotony of the overhead announcements heard in train stations and airports. But the men and women did not part quickly. Instead, they clung to one another, arms around necks. Couples who had not held each other this way for years, who had perhaps never held each other this way in public, embraced deeply. It was a party that had simply gone on too long. The music had stopped and the dancing had stopped, and still the couples stood, each enveloped in the other, waiting. The only awkward pairing was between Roxanne Koss and the accompanist. She looked so small in his arms, she seemed almost a child. She didn't appear to want to be held by him, but on closer inspection she was actually shoring him up. He draped himself on her, and the grimace on her face was that of a woman unequal to the weight that had been given her. Mr. Hosokawa, recognizing her distress, Because he had been watching, having no one to embrace himself, his own wife safely home in Tokyo, took the accompanist in his arms, wrapping the much larger man across his shoulders like a coat in warmer weather. Mr. Hosokawa staggered a bit himself, but it was nothing compared with the relief that flooded her face.
Thank you, she said.
Thank you, he repeated.
You'll look after him?
At this point, the accompanist raised his head and took some of his weight onto his own feet.
Thank you,
Mr. Hosokawa repeated tenderly. Other men, single men, mostly waiters, all of whom wished that they had been the one to peel this dying gringo from her shoulders, moved forward to help Mr. Hosokawa, and together they shuffled to the left side of the room with the sour-smelling man, his blonde head swinging as if his neck had been snapped. Mr. Hosokawa turned to look at her, so heartsick, to think she would be alone. He might have thought that she was watching him, but really she was looking at her accompanist, who was slumped in Mr. Hosokawa's arms. Once he was away from her, it was much easier to see how ill he looked. Now, in the face of so many passionate goodbyes, it struck Mr. Hosokawa that he had never even considered bringing his wife to this country. He did not tell her that she had been invited. He told her he was attending a business meeting, not a birthday party to be held in his honor. Their unspoken agreement was that Mrs. Hosokawa always stayed home with their daughters. They did not travel together. Now he could see how smart this decision was. He had kept his wife from discomfort and possibly harm. He had protected her. But still he couldn't help but wonder what it would have been like for the two of them to stand together now. Would they have felt so much sadness when they were told to step away from one another? For what seemed like a long time, but could not have been a whole minute, Edith and Simone Thibault said nothing to each other. Then she kissed him and he said,
I like to think of you outside.
He could have said anything, it made no difference. He was thinking of those first 20 years they were married, years when he had loved her without any kind of real understanding. This would be his punishment now, for all his time wasted.
Dear Edith,
she took off the light silk wrapper she was wearing. He had forgotten to ask for it. It was a wonderful blue, the blue used on the dinner plates of kings and the underbreasts of the birds in this very godforsaken jungle. She crumpled it up into a surprisingly small ball and pressed it into the waiting cup of his hands.
Don't do anything stupid, she said,
and because it was the last thing she asked of him, he swore he would not. For the most part, the separation of hostages was civil. No two had to be pried apart with a gun. When they knew their time was really up, the men and the women separated, as if a complicated dancing reel were about to begin, and soon they would join and split and change, passing their partners off only to receive them back into their arms again. Messner took a stack of business cards out of his wallet and handed one to each of the generals, and one to Gen and one, thoughtfully, to the vice president, and then left the rest in a dish on the coffee table.
This has my cell phone number, he said. That's just me. You want to talk to me, you call this number. They're keeping the phone lines open to the house for now.
Each of them looked at the cards, feeling puzzled. It was as if he was asking them to lunch, as if he didn't understand the gravity of the situation.
You may need something, Messner said. You may want to talk to someone out there.
Gen made a slight bow. He should have bowed to the waist for Messner to show him respect for coming into this place, for risking his life for theirs, but he knew that no one would understand. Then Mr. Hosokawa came up and took a card from the dish, shook Messner's hand and bowed deeply, his face turned down to the floor. After that, the generals Benjamin, Alfredo, and Hector went to the men, and from that pack cut out the workers, the waiters and cooks and cleaning staff, and placed them with the women. It was their ultimate intention to free the workers through revolution, and they would not keep them hostage. Then they asked if anyone was very ill, and had Gen repeat the question several times. Where one would think that every member would claim a faint heart, the crowd was remarkably quiet. A handful of very old men shuffled forward. A handsome Italian man showed a medical identification bracelet and was reunited to the arms of his wife. Only one man lied,
and his lie was not discovered. Dr. Gomez explained that his kidneys had failed years before and he was late for dialysis already. His wife turned away from him, ashamed. The sickest among them, the accompanist, appeared too confused to make the request for himself, and so was placed into a chair at the side where they would be certain not to forget him. The priests were given leave as well. Monsignor Roland made the sign of the cross over those who remained, a lovely gesture, and then walked away. But Father Arguedas, who really had no pressing duties to attend to, requested permission to stay.
"Stay?" General Alfredo said.
"You'll need a priest," he said.
Alfredo smiled slightly, and this was a first.
"Really? You'll want to go?"
"If the people are here through Sunday, you'll need someone to say Mass.
We will pray on our own."
"Respectfully, sir," said the priest, his eyes cast down, "I will stay." And with that, the matter was closed. Monsignor Roland could do nothing but helplessly watch the whole thing. He was already standing with the women, and the shame of it filled him with murderous rage. He could have choked the young priest to death with one hand. But it was too late. He had already been saved. The vice president should have been given medical leave, but didn't even bother asking. Instead, sick with fever and holding a melted ice pack to his face, he was told to go out the door and down to the heavy gate in the wall to announce the release to the press. He barely had a second with his own wife, a decent woman who made the work of her life the well-being of his career and never said a word as she watched him throw her work away. He didn't have a minute with his two daughters, Imelda and Rosa, who had been so good, lying all day on their sides, playing some complicated finger game with each other that he could not recognize. He said nothing to Esmeralda because there were no words to thank her. He was worried about her. If he was killed, would they keep her on? He hoped so. She had such a lovely straight back and was patient with the children. She had taught them to paint pictures of animals on small rocks, and from those rocks, elaborate worlds were made. There were plenty of them upstairs. Sooner or later, he would be able to get away and go and find them. His wife clutched at their son until he cried out from the pressure of her hands. She was afraid they would try and take him to the side with the men, but Rubén stroked her fingers and reassured her. "No one will count him," he said. He kissed Marco on the head, kissed his silky, deeply boyish-smelling hair. Then he went to the door. He was a better man for the job than President Masuda. The president couldn't say anything unless it was written down. He was not a stupid man, but he lacked spontaneity. Besides, he had a temper and false pride and would not stand being ordered from the floor to the door and back again. He would say something unscripted and get himself shot, which would eventually lead to everyone getting shot. For the first time, he thought it was better that Masuda had stayed home to watch his soap opera, because Rubén could be the servant, the straight man. And in doing so, he could save the lives of his wife and his children and their pretty governess, and the famous Roxanne Koss. The particular job he had been given this time was in fact more suited to the talents of a vice president. Messner came out and joined him on the front steps. The day had clouded over, but the air was marvelous. The people at the end of the walkway lowered their guns, and out came the women, their dresses shimmering in the late afternoon light. Were it not for all the police and photographers, a person walking by might have thought it was a party where every couple had fought, and the women all took it upon themselves to leave early and alone. They were crying, and their hair fell into tangled knots. Their makeup was ruined, and their skirts were held up in their fists. Most of them carried their shoes, or had left their shoes behind, and their stockings were torn on the flat shale stones of the front walk, though none of them noticed. There should have been a sinking ship behind them, a burning building. The farther they got from the house, the harder they cried. The few men, the servants, the infirm, came out behind them, looking helpless in the face of so much sadness for which they were not responsible.